Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest chapter, the latest exciting adventures from life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, the rock a chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Ms. Jones, I hope you're well and that you've enjoyed Easter, which, of course, is now well behind us. We don't like to dwell on heavy, serious subjects on life on Planet Porky, but nobody can ignore the very, very tragic news over the last 24 hours that Ronaldo, the world's most famous footballer, the world's most successful footballer in terms of goals he scored and awards he's won, has suffered the loss of one of two twins born to him and his girlfriend, Georgina. That's a terrible tragedy for any parent to have to cope with, isn't it?
It really is. And, you know, it's all very well being the world's most famous footballer, yeah, the most successful, the oldest Premier League footballer. You know, there are so many things that make him stand out.
Yes.
But this is one of those unifying tragedies. There is no greater heartache than the death of a baby.
Yeah.
And, of course, this is twisted by the fact that one of the twins that they were expecting, he and his wife, Georgina, yeah, has survived. Thank God she has.
Yes.
So they've kept their little baby girl. And that is tinged with the desperate loss of that little baby's brother, who they now have to think about burying. And so all the joy of being new parents of this lovely little girl is offset, if you like, by the awfulness that they have to go through,
yeah,
with a funeral for the twin. Look, he's got five kids, hasn't he?
Yes.
Now, it does underline the notion that we always have to bear in mind, which is that love divided is undiminished. Mm. However many children we have, we don't love the ones we already have any less.
Mm.
Yeah, so they are never going to forget this little boy.
Mm.
And they will, you do this through life. I had a miscarriage years ago. And to this day, this is a long time ago, but I always think about that little baby on the birthday.
Yeah.
You know, what they would, how old would they be now? What would they be doing these days?
I didn't know that. You know, I've known you a long time. Yeah. Sorry to have heard that. And my total sympathy.
Thank you. It never leaves you, see, that's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
And that they will always, I don't know what photographs they've got, whether they've got any mementos. They do encourage that kind of thing these days. So you are encouraged to hold your deceased baby.
Yeah.
You are encouraged to keep the blanket and little wristband that they give you in hospital.
Sure.
All the tiny things that give you something to hold on to. In the old days, it was swept under the carpet.
Mm.
A child died. That was an awful tragedy, of course.
Mm.
But people were in denial about those things. We're much more in touch with our emotions, our feelings these days.
Mm.
And it's considered much more healthy to hang on to things of that
person that you've lost. And sort of openly grieve, you mean, rather than bury it. Yeah. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
But what an awful thing for them to have to go through, and they have all my sympathy.
Yeah, of course, they've got the world's sympathy. I've seen a picture, I think it was last night rather than this morning, of them both holding up the scans, because obviously they're expecting twins. So Ronaldo's holding one scan, his girlfriend's holding the other. You never seen such joy in the parents' faces. They've already had a set of twins, so they knew the joy that twins bring, you know, but my goodness me, I don't know. You've got everything in life, everything in life. No man could have more. He earns £775,000 a week, right, at Manchester United, the most feted footballer in the world. And yet, bang, he might as well be a bricklayer earning, you know, £25 a day or something like that for all it means to him. Now, it brings me to what Paul McCartney said when his wife Linda sadly died of breast cancer. I cover that story from start to finish. I got in with your mate of mine, Jeff, who was Paul McCartney's press officer, wasn't he?
Oh, Jeff Baker.
Jeff Baker, that's right. And I was running the Press Association at the time, and Jeff thought it would be a good idea to funnel all the news out through the National News Agency, the Press Association, so that he wouldn't get, you know, constantly bombarded with people, of course, who found this a fascinating story. And the one quote I always remember from Paul McCartney, Sir Paul McCartney, was, "Nobody in life gets a free ride." And what he meant by that was, it doesn't matter what you've got in life or what you've achieved or what your status is, human tragedy can hit you as much as it can hit anybody else.
Of course. And we can't put a price on life. You know, you cannot buy. People will say, oh, he's had a surrogate child before, so he did buy a baby, effectively. But, you know, it's splitting hairs. It's that bond between a parent and a child is something so precious. And no amount of money will substitute for that.
Yeah, no,
he is going through the same grief as anybody else who's ever lost a child. And it's the great unifier, isn't it?
Yes.
Grief is the price we pay for love.
Yes, no, I totally agree. So on a brighter note, we just talked about Paul McCartney. I have to say, I saw a picture this week and it really lifted my spirit and lifted my heart. I saw Sir Paul McCartney and Sir Ringo Starr hugging each other in a restaurant in California, and just behind them were their respective wives, Barbara Bach and is it Nancy?
Nancy Cheville.
Cheville, that's right, yeah.
And although she's, of course, Nancy McCartney.
Yeah, well, she is, yeah, Lady McCartney, I suppose. And I just thought, and they both looked so young. You know, Macca has shown his age in recent years because he's coming up towards 80, but he looked so young and full head of hair and that cheeky smile, and there he was hugging Ringo Starr. And you think of what those two men have been through and created and the mark they've put on the world. And it just lifted me. And the other odd thing is there, which I didn't know, is that there was a third guy there, but he was just in the background. And it's Joe Walsh, who is apparently the lead guitarist of the Eagles. And the reason he was there is because he's married to Barbara Bach's wife. I didn't know that.
No, Barbara Bach's sister.
Oh, sister, sorry, wife, yeah, Barbara Bach's sister, yeah.
Yeah, no, that, I mean, they've been together for donkey's years, yeah.
Yeah.
It's not that unusual an occurrence, I have to say. They are very close. And whenever Paul is out on tour, which he often is every couple of years, we're due a tour this year. He will start in America quite soon, and I hope we will get him in the autumn winter. He always brings Ringo out on stage,
and
Ringo plays a couple of songs with him. You know, they are close. They're the last two remaining Beatles.
Well, exactly.
They've had no axe to grind all their lives. There was never a falling out between McCartney and Starr.
No.
As there was between John and Paul, of course.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, they're very often on different continents, but they do take these opportunities to get together and regroup when they find themselves, as in this case, in Los Angeles at the same time. But wherever they happen to be, they do make the effort. I think it's a lovely thing.
Yeah, I do as well. Ringo must have fallen out with somebody because he walked out on the band once, didn't he? Was that because of all the terrible rows between John and Paul and George?
There was a lot going down at that time. Yeah. If you remember, Ringo Starr was married to Maureen Starkey, as she was known, because that was his original name.
Yeah.
And Ringo got into a phase of heavy drug use and alcohol abuse, that kind of thing. And he and Maureen broke up. And George Harrison seduced Maureen.
Really?
And the rest of the band went berserk about
it. Ringo's and one wife? Of them, George Harrison had sex with Ringo's wife?
Yes.
This is a shocking revelation.
Well, it's not a revelation. It's in my book on John Lennon.
Nevertheless, Miss Jones, to be talking like this about, you know, the intimacy of the Beatles with the fellow Beatles' wives is quite a shocking thing.
Well, the rest of them didn't forgive George for that. They said that they'd known Maureen for such a long time, since she was about 16 years old, that this amounted to incest.
Good God. I mean, she was a hat check girl, wasn't she, at the Cavern, along with Cilla Black?
No, she wasn't. She was a hairdresser.
Oh, a hairdresser. Okay, yeah. But in Liverpool, hairdresser in Liverpool, who became world famous for marrying the Beatles' drummer. Pretty good, that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, very good. Yeah. Very, very good.
Oh, well, that's, I must say, I didn't know about that intricate web of, you know, into rock passion. George seemed to go around shagging quite a lot of women, didn't he? Wasn't that choosy. I mean, he didn't even mind giving his wife away to Eric Clapton, did he?
Oh, it's an odd thing, isn't it? I mean, there were stories about, you remember when they had the Apple offices in Savile Row?
Yes,
Apple Scruffs. All those, the girls who used to hang around outside and George apparently was a bit of a curb crawler. You know, he'd come out, he'd get in his fancy car and he'd sort of drive along and eye up the women, and he'd pick up a couple of them and take them back with him. He was quite indiscriminate about that kind of thing. We have this impression of George being the sweet, wide-eyed, cuddly one, the innocent one, don't we? Yeah. But I think it was more sinister than that.
Oh, dear. Sinister, right? Right. As we are recording, Miss Jones, we're not allowed to get political on Life on Planet Porky, but it is the 1,000th day of Boris Johnson's premiership. And you have to ask yourself, how many more after the 1,000 landmark will he get to?
It's looking dodgy for him, isn't it?
Well, I would say it is I'd say it is a bit. Just as you and I have recorded now, he's made another apology in the Commons, OK? Now, it all gets dusted down in tomorrow morning's papers all the time, doesn't it? So we're talking about this morning as people are listening to this podcast, because that seems to shape a lot of people's thinking.
I think, you know, we knew when he came to office that he had a reputation for dishonesty and for blatant lying, we'd have to call it. And he's been called out on so many occasions now. The thing I can't get past is the fact that he lied in Parliament and brazenly, as if that is his right.
The Grey report is still due to come out, and I don't think it's been established yet whether it was it was lies or whatever. I think she's waiting to publish that, but... Look, I mean, everybody's got an opinion. I did a TV show this week, and I was on the show to speak up for Boris Johnson, because I think he's got so many good qualities, like, you know, leading the country in the Ukrainian situation and having got...
Yeah, but hang on about that.
Yeah.
You know, he has given the impression that the UK is at war here with Russia, and we are not at war. Mm. We are supporting a country who is at war unwittingly and not of their own volition or choice. We are lending support. We are sending hardware. We're bringing their people here to get away from the conflict. Yeah. But we're not at war. And I feel that he is hiding behind that.
Well, look, as I say, we don't have to get political on this, but everybody's got their view. That's what we love about a democracy. Talking about points of view, right? Am I the only one who suspects that the reason Harry suddenly popped up with Meghan and gave 15 precious minutes of his time to go to see the Queen of England, his grandmother, might have been because of the fact that he had a Netflix crew in tow with him? Can't people see this and say, hang on, the Netflix documentary is going to be worth a lot more if it records his first meeting with the Queen in 18 months?
Well, there's a couple of mistakes there, if I may.
Right.
He didn't spend 15 minutes with Her Majesty the Queen. He spent rather longer. They spent rather longer with her than that. Mm. The 15 minutes referred to the meeting he had with his father.
Right, Prince Charles,
the Prince of Wales, no cameras were present at either of those meetings.
No, but they will have shown him going in to where the meeting was and coming out from where the meeting was, Windsor Castle, so it all adds to the flavour.
I guess it does, but nothing was recorded on camera with Her Majesty or with Prince Charles. I'm sure that the meeting with Charles was very fraught because neither of them wanted that conflict, that interrogation, if you like. It had to be done.
Yep.
The Queen has this wonderful ability to smooth troubled waters, doesn't she?
Yes.
She's very family driven. Mm. She loves all her family equally. And she's always said, you know, she wants peace among her clan. Harry and Meghan are still very much part of her family and still very much loved. Yep. The tragedy is that she's been deprived of her grandchildren.
Yes.
They're two little kids. What are they? Archie and Lily, I think.
Lilibet.
Yeah, but they call her Lily.
Do they?
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that that's tremendously sad because the Queen is 97. She's not going to live forever.
Yeah.
And she has now invited them onto the balcony during the Platinum Jubilee celebration.
I know, amazing.
Now, that is going to take some guts to stand there among the clan with all that hostility flying about, because Kate and William aren't very keen on
that. No, they're very unkeen. Yeah, go on.
And they're going to be scrutinised. Mm. Every single flicker of an eye, every twist of a lip, every little glance is going to have all kinds read into it and be plastered all over the papers and the television the next day.
Yes, I agree.
This is going to take some guts. We know that Meg's an actress.
Yeah.
We don't quite know
Who's going to have the guts then to go through with this?
Well, I think Meghan and Harry are going
to don't deserve any sympathy for it. And they behave disgracefully, in my view. And I did read that though, even if they get on the balcony, they will be barred from taking part in Trooping the Colour, you know, which is the traditional sort of annual parade of the Queen's.
Yeah, but only the Queen troops the colour. No other member of... Well, Princess Anne has stood in for her a couple of times,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
The Queen. But they don't all troop the colour. They don't all get on a horse and trot round.
Oh, okay.
The rest of them view it from the balcony,
yeah,
don't they?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, well, as you say. Anyway, look, just getting to the royals, I have to say, I'm not a fashion expert by any stretch of the imagination, but I saw Kate in a pale blue outfit this week. It was like a sort of dress coat or something. And I thought, wow, she looks sensational. And then, excuse me, I reflected that every time I see her dressed, I think she's absolutely immaculate. I think she's better at dressing than even Diana, Princess of Wales, was.
Yeah, I sort of resent the obsession with her outfits.
Yeah.
I mean, is it normal for people to wear clothes more than once? They make such a big deal of this. Mm. This baby blue Amelia Wickstead dress that she wore to the Easter service.
Oh, is that what it was? Is it? Yeah.
Okay. Yes. She first wore that in 2017.
Right.
On an official visit to Luxembourg. Mm-hmm. And a big deal has been made of that. Do you not buy suits and do I not buy clothes that we wear multiple times?
Yes, of course.
To get our money's worth.
Yeah.
So why is it considered so shock horror when a royal wears something more than once?
Yeah.
I find this absolutely weird. But, I mean, think of the time she spends forward planning her outfits, consulting designers,
yeah,
having fittings. It's all a bit self-obsessed. Do we care? Well, this is why I wear black all the time, which is my uniform.
Yeah.
I've got 15 pairs of black trousers, about 20 black shirts of different styles,
yeah,
and I switch it up with a scarf here and there. Mm. But I do not want to have to think about clothes all the time. I know that she's photographed all over the world, wherever she goes.
Yeah.
But to me, it's a little bit spoilt. Mm. Look at me. I've got thousands upon thousands of pounds to spend on my wardrobe.
Yeah.
The rest of you can stay home and eat bread and drink.
Oh, well, I don't look at it like that at all. I'm glad she makes an effort because she is, as far as I'm concerned, a great advert for this country. But you're right about clothes. I've got, in my wardrobe, I've got 10 black suits, okay? I've got 10 black suits. I've got one blue jacket, one grey jacket, one blue blazer. But the only thing I look good in, because I'm overweight and, you know, I don't have any sort of, you know, defined body shape, is a black suit. Seriously. And I like a black suit and a blue shirt. I've got about 30 blue shirts, stripes or checks or, you know, white with blue stripes in them. And you're absolutely right. For a bloke never gets sort of, you know, the microscope on him about what he's wearing today, because he's wearing a dark suit, which is what most male politicians wear, whereas females are always picked up on their fashion. But, you know, that's the great thing about being a woman. They need to look attractive, in my view, and it's a wonderful thing to see.
So I'm a pretty anti-woman in that case because I just want to wear black suits all the time.
You look great
well.
In black, Leslie Ann. Look at all the pictures that I've seen of you over the years and the pictures and you know that appear in your books and all that. You always look great. I wouldn't worry about
thank
it to the extent where, you know, you even have your black sunglasses on most of the time.
Most of the time. Do you remember when we worked on Fleet Street?
Yeah.
We had to turn up to work every day looking as though we could be presentable at a wedding or a funeral. Mm. We had to wear dresses, the girls. We couldn't wear trousers
yeah.
in the office.
Yeah.
We had to have a little bit of discreet jewellery. We always had to have our passport
yeah.
in our handbag or in our pocket.
Yeah.
But we couldn't go around looking the way journalists look today, which is dead scruffy.
No, I agree. That was the very first lesson I ever got when I worked on the Chester Chronicle. You know, sending you off to see the local vicar because of some tragedy, you know, the church has gone on fire or something like that. Or we might be sending you down to the very worst council estate because there's been a riot, you know, or something like that. And, yeah, you're absolutely right. Jacket, tie, shirt, you know, trousers and all that kind of stuff. And that one about always carry your passport. I carried my passport for about the first 4 years in my job as a reporter and never went further than the sort of the borders of the county in which I worked. But it got used a lot more, obviously, later in my career. Let me ask you this, Miss Jones. Do you, like me, does your heart bleed these days and do you get very sad when you go down your local high street, wherever that might be, or any high street, and you see all the shops boarded up? I hate it. I love the high streets of this country, particularly smaller towns where they've got small local shops, and it's all beginning to crumble to dust.
It is very sad. The BBC tell us that nearly 50 outlets a day are closing.
Yeah.
This is due to the impact of the pandemic, the internet, changing shopping habits. It's very expensive to lease premises, run and staff a shop.
Yes, it is.
And people have woken up to that. And I'm afraid it's not going back, because it's too easy for the vast majority of people to go online, find what they want on Amazon or some other site, hit a button, and a couple of days later, or maybe even the next day, knock on the door and there it is, you know. And because people are working from home an awful lot more these days, it's much more convenient to have things delivered. That used to be a problem when they might leave it on the doorstep or bring it to your place of work, but the department is not findable and whatever else. It was too complicated.
Yeah.
But nowadays, I think all of that has become much more streamlined, and I don't think the high street is going to make a return.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. I can't see how it's ever going to happen again, because, as you quite rightly say, the cost of occupying a building is so enormous. Talking about buildings and streets and high streets, do you see that report that the best place to live in this country is on the coast, and that the benefits of living on the coast, you know, the fresh air, you know, the sight of the sea, just the very ambience of the coastline and beaches and all that kind of stuff makes for a better life. And most people know I've got a second home and it's on the coast, and I get all those sort of feelings. You know, you can smell the salt in the air, or whatever that smell is that comes off beaches, saline, I think it's called, or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's just lovely. I do love the car. I love to hear the sea swishing in. I love to see the waves, rolling up and down. It really is. But the other thing I found is that I can't stay on the coast for very long, because you can't get your work done there. You know, it's usually a very long way from the centre of where you're working, and people think that if you're out there and it's remote, then, you know, you're not in working mood, really.
It makes me laugh, this kind of survey, because, you know, there's nothing new here. The University of Exeter, back in 2012, and I know quite a bit about this because I had a daughter at Exeter at the time, at university there. And they proved this theory all those years ago that, you know, they used data, I think, from the census. What would it have been? The 2001 census, I think. Mm. And they got responses from 48 million people. So it was a huge study.
Right.
And they say people do feel calmer, more relaxed and more revitalized by a visit to the seaside than to any city park or the countryside.
Yes.
Because, as you so rightly said, the sea is a stress reliever. Mm. The sound of the waves releases the mind.
Yeah,
the waves coming in and crashing and receding and repeating, it destimulates the brain. And that's a very good thing.
Yeah.
And you've also got that smell of salt water, the feeling of warm sand between your toes.
Yeah.
This is not just nostalgia for our childhood seaside holidays. It's all to do with stress relieving.
Right.
If you think, for example, about the colour blue, which conveys calmness, doesn't it?
Well, just to me, because everything in my life is blue. As I'm sitting in my office now, the curtains are blue, the carpet's blue, everything's blue.
Well, that's because you're an Evertonian.
It is,
But, you know, looking at the sea and sky, filling your lungs with ocean mist and taking away those negative ions, you know, that has a profound antidepressant effect.
No, I'm
so I absolutely get this, but what I'm saying is, no point calling this a new study, as they have, because we've known this for a long time.
It's no surprise. Yeah, I mean, ages ago, I bought a property in the northeast. I'm determined one of these days to retire to Northumberland and literally walk my Labrador dog up and down the beach in the morning. But I've never found the right moment. When I thought
you haven't got a Labrador dog, either.
No, but I'll get one. I'll buy a cottage near the beach. And then go and get a Labrador dog from somewhere, and then I'll be made up. But the point is, I don't think I can handle finally cutting myself off from work altogether, because if I lived on the northeast coast, I would have cut myself off. I might get some work in radio in Newcastle or something like that, you know. But generally speaking, you're away from London, where, you know, without sounding, you know, London-centric and metropolitan, a lot of my industry is based, and a lot of yours is in the publishing world, you know. So that's all. But I've got to, I'm determined now that if I come to a certain birth date, maybe when I'm 70, I am just going to shut everything down and go and walk that damned Labrador up and down the damn beach in somewhere like Colourcoats or something like that. Okay, folks, this episode of Planet Porky is brought to you by Surfshark. The internet is getting more dangerous by the second. Hackers have more ways to target you. Trackers are following your every move. And malware is hiding all over the web. Now, luckily, there is a solution. You can get a VPN. It will hide your real location, making you more difficult to identify and thus to target. But privacy and security are not all that Surfshark has to offer. If you use a VPN, you will forget about geo restrictions. You'll be able to forget about them altogether, okay? You'll be able to access everything from news sources to social media apps that are unavailable to you because of your location. Now, just change your virtual location and access all the entertainment you want safely and securely. And you can try out Surfshark completely risk-free because they have a 30-day money-back guarantee. Get Surfshark VPN at surfshark.deals/porky. Use the promo code PORKY for 83% off and 3 extra months free. So let me just repeat that to you. That is surfshark.deals/porky. Righto, folks, you're listening to Life on Planet Porky. You're listening to me, the Porkmeister, and, of course, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Well, we've been a bit gloomy so far, Ms. Jones, in things that we've been talking about. But, you know, it's I suppose it's the way the world is at the moment. We can't get away from the gloom because I'm going to talk to you about Julia Bradbury, who is, in my view, an outstanding TV presenter who walks around Britain. Don't know if you've ever seen any of her shows. I know you're not a huge television watcher, but a wonderful woman. I've done some shows with her, and I was very distressed when she announced last year that she'd contracted breast cancer, which she's now fighting. But she very openly illustrated what breast cancer is all about for women, even to the extent where the surgeon who treated her had put felt-tip marks across her chest, indicating what had to be done. And I thought that was rather, you know, rather brave to be able to open your life up to that extent to millions of people.
She's an incredibly courageous woman. To know that you've got to have this mutilation of your body, and breasts, whatever we think about breasts, are symbolic of womanhood and femininity, and we've suckled our babies there. You know, they are hugely indicative of how we feel about ourselves as women. And her diagnosis was last September 2021. Only a month later, she was undergoing this double mastectomy, which is, this kind of thing would drive some people mad. You know, she has stepped up to this. She's not only dealing with it for herself, but she's made a documentary to spread awareness to help other women. And she has said quite openly, I have to learn to live with this. She has stage 4 cancer, so there's a very high risk here of her cancer returning. She says that she accepts the fragility of life, and she has to go on with her life without this consuming her. So I think amazingly brave woman, and you know, all power to her. I hope she overcomes it, and I hope she lives for many years to come.
The last time I spoke to her, she was bringing out a book on walking, and we'd done some radio work together, and I told her my story about being on the heart transplant list, but I never had a heart transplant. And she said, how did you get around it? And I said, well, I put it down to walking. She said, what? And I said, yeah, for about the next 10 years, I walked at least 30 miles a week on the North and South Downs where I lived. And so she asked me to write a chapter for the book on the, you know, because walking is her business, but the health benefits of walking. And just as we were about to get going on it, she got this terrible diagnosis. So I'm looking forward very, very much indeed to picking up on it, you know, and working with her again as soon as possible. I'm afraid the bad news doesn't go away on today's Planet Porky, Leslie Ann, because I've had some terrible news in the last 48 hours. A colleague of mine who I worked with for many, many years in radio, probably 20 years, man much younger than me, Nigel Pearson, suddenly died at the age of 52 of a brain aneurysm. People don't realise how common this can be in middle-aged men, and honestly, I'm absolutely devastated for his family.
That's awful news. What happened to you?
Well, he just collapsed.
He dropped dead.
You just drop dead when you get a brain aneurysm. 1 minute you're as good as gold. Next minute, bang. I think I've told you the story before. I had another mate who suffered the same fate at a much earlier age. He was about 38. His name was Ian Sangster, Sangy, mate of mine. We worked together on the Birmingham Mail for years. I moved on. Ian stayed there and made a career, rose to become a senior executive on the paper. And he was standing in his kitchen with a towel wrapped round him, with a glass of whiskey in his left hand and a cigarette in his right hand, while his girlfriend was cooking the spaghetti bolognese, and he just collapsed backwards and hit the floor. And she thought, oh, he's gone unconscious because he hit the floor. In fact, he was dead before he hit the floor. A brain aneurysm is like a vessel at the back of your head, and it can just burst.
Well, this happened years ago. My eldest daughter, when she was about 8 years old, at school, she had a lovely little friend called Olivia.
Yeah.
And on New Year's Day Eve, the day before New Year's Day.
Yes, so that's, they were, yeah, New Year's Eve, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the day before New Year's
Eve. Yes, yes.
She and her brother had been given new bikes by Father Christmas, and Mum and Dad, Tony and Sally, and Piers, her little brother, and Olivia were all out on the common in Streatham trying out the new bikes.
Right.
And Sally, the mum, said, I was watching her sort of streaking away on the new bike. She turned around and she came back towards me, and she just, in slow motion, keeled off the bike. And by the time Olivia hit the floor, she was dead. And that the same thing happened, brain aneurysm.
Yeah.
And then we were looking at photographs of all the kids at school in the subsequent months.
Yeah.
And looking closely at Olivia, you could tell that there was something wrong.
How?
After the fact, there was a look in her eyes. What? There was just a sort of haunted look about her.
God.
That we weren't kidding ourselves. There was, you could definitely see that something in that child had changed, and nobody had picked up on it, because you're not expecting it.
Hmm.
So you're not looking for something to be wrong.
Yeah.
But you could definitely see that child was on the way out.
Golly, that's so sad, isn't it? Absolutely sad. Karen Brady, who's often described as the first woman of football, she's vice chairman of West Ham United, and also obviously has a broadcasting career with The Apprentice, with Sugar. She just had a routine medical, because in the high-powered jobs like hers, you often routinely have to have an annual medical for insurance purposes and all that. And they detected a swollen vein in the back of her head. And if it had been two or three more weeks, they said she would have had an aneurysm, and they operated, and she literally had a brain surgery to save her life. I mean,
That kind of thing is just so amazing. I remember Frank Warren telling me, the boxing promoter, he's my youngest daughter's godfather.
Yes.
And you remember he was famously shot. We're not allowed to say who did it,
exactly.
But we know who did it.
Yeah.
And he was rushed to hospital, and where the bullet had sort of gone in or grazed across the back of his neck, I think it was. They were preparing him for surgery, and they happened to find a tumor.
Good God.
That he wouldn't have known about otherwise.
No, I didn't know that.
And he underwent surgery, and his life was saved.
Yeah. Golly.
So, he was a very fortunate person to get shot. it's an ill wind, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely weird. Talking about people in the entertainment business, Chris Tarrant's got a book out, okay? And
I've been reading it in the Daily Mail. Yeah.
Exactly, and it's been serialised and all that. And I have to say that I haven't always got on with Chris. I've found him a bumcher sometimes, but he's very, very successful. I mean, one of the most successful DJs we've ever had, and for so many years, Capital Radio in London, record listening figures, and he got paid extremely well for it. And then Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? But the best part of it was his start. He actually started writing to TV stations, radio stations, pretending that he was already an established broadcaster, and he had offers from ITV and offers from here, and he was going to be snapped up, but he was giving them the opportunity to take him on first. And two stations, I think one of them was ATV in the Midlands, and I don't know who the other one was, Granada or something, I actually thought this guy might have something. And that's how he started his broadcasting career. Now, it doesn't matter what you think about the way Chris Tarrant, progressed in his career. He did Tis Was and all that. But you can't, you certainly can't criticise the boy for initiative and attempts, can you?
No, very brave and very out there.
Yep.
Some people find him smirky and smug. I don't. Mm. He is a nice bloke. I knew him when I worked at Capital Radio years ago.
Yeah.
My very close friend, Russ Kane, was his flying eye for about 25 years.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Russ used to go up in the plane and do the traffic spotting.
What a great job that was, eh? Yeah.
Yeah, but he had to be at Elstree Strip, whatever it is, at 4 o'clock every morning.
Great.
Come rain or shine. Yeah. I went up in it once and I was as sick as a dog.
Oh,
I was sitting
really?
In the back
with a
carrier bag between my knees.
Yeah.
It was, I could never in a million have done that every day. But Ross did. Mm. And I thought that the rapport between them on air was just so special, so sensational.
Yeah.
And it's a shame they're not doing it today because nobody else is doing that.
No, they're not. They gave that up.
He's, I tell you what he is. Yes, they did.
Yeah.
That breakfast show gig is a hard one.
Yes.
It's very tough. And they did it, as I say, for about 25 years. Mm. And then he could take no more. His marriage broke up. He got together with somebody else. Mm. What I will say is that he's much more palatable than Noel Edmonds ever was.
Oh, really? Why do you say that?
There's something more approachable, more natural, more human about Chris.
Yeah.
Noel Edmonds always seemed a bit plastic compared.
Yeah. Noel Edmonds, my sister worked for brewing company. She introduced Miller Lite into this country from Milwaukee. What made Milwaukee famous? May loser out of me. And she brought it to the country. And for some unknown reason, Noel Edmonds got involved, you know, on a big sponsorship deal, something like that. And he used to fly my sister around in his own helicopter.
Yeah, he was involved in that heliport down at Battersea,
was he? Yeah, I didn't know that. Yeah, but
didn't he fly a whole bunch of the artists to Wembley Stadium on the day of Live Aid?
I think he did. Yeah, or certainly to an aerodrome nearby. Yeah, no, I think he did. Old Chris Tarrant used to live in Esher, which is not far from me in Stockbroker Belt, Surrey. So you'd see him occasionally in the wine bars and all that, and he was a lot of fun, Chris, you know what I mean? He liked getting involved with people, and that led, unfortunately, to his divorce eventually from Ingrid. And I've worked with Ingrid quite a bit over the last 18 months and broadcasting, and she's great fun as well, you know. I don't know if you ever got to know her.
I have met her on a few occasions because she was a great friend of Graham Dean, who was another presenter at Capital Radio.
Okay.
And they used to go to football together. So sometimes we'd all be having lunch on a Saturday in one of the restaurants near to Capital Radio, which was in those days at Euston Tower on the Euston Road.
Yep.
And Ingrid would come in to pick up Graham and off they would go to football. And that was how she met Chris Tarrant.
Oh, I see. Oh, right. Yeah, I see.
Because she was Graham Dean's mate. Yeah.
Amazing. But there you go. That's how careers start and that's how they stop, isn't it, really? They split up now, of course, Chris and Ingrid. And I didn't realise Chris is now in his mid-70s and even in those pieces we read, you know, the civilization, starting to feel the pace a bit. But you do when you're in your mid-70s. He's got this obsession with fishing, hasn't he? Absolutely.
Yeah,
obsession.
Yeah.
But you know what? It's the one thing that has absolutely no attraction for me ever in my life, even as a kid.
My former husband was big into fishing.
Right.
And the very first holiday we had together was we had to go to this place called Delphi Lodge in Galway in Ireland.
Right.
Because he went there for 2 weeks every single early summer and joined in this kind of salmon fishing shebang.
Yeah.
It was a beautiful place. Mm. The Prince of Wales had been there. His signature was in the visitor's book and so on. And I basically sat around all day. I took up embroidery. Can you imagine?
Well done.
Yeah. LAJ took up embroidery for something to do while my husband was out on the river.
Yeah.
That's how boring it was. Mm. But I did embroider this Welsh dragon in cross stitch, which I had framed and gave to my father. And after my father died, my mother gave it back to me.
Oh,
and I have
lovely.
It right on the shelf here in front of me. Yeah. But fishing, no thanks. I mean, yeah. Not for me. But yeah, he was obsessed with it. And Ingrid said,
yeah.
One of the funny things she said after they divorced, in a piece in a newspaper I read, that she couldn't stand to share a bed with him anymore because he stank of fish.
Yeah, well, that's what it is. I mean, fish are slimy and all that. I can see the attraction of fishing. When I was a real little kid, when I was about 8 or 9, a mate of ours had a house which backed onto a canal, okay? And people used to fish in the canal. So it was quite exciting, you know, and sitting there, you know, and your rod in the water waiting for a bite and all this kind of stuff. That was quite exciting as a kid of about 8. But I just do not know. Jack Charlton was huge into fishing, wasn't he? An old friend of yours. And I just don't know how you can empty your mind for hours and hours at a time sitting on a little stool on a riverbank staring at the water. I mean, it's almost like meditation.
But I think that is the point,
yep.
That they can only concentrate on the job in hand, yep. Which is catching that fish,
yeah.
To the exclusion of all else.
Yeah.
So it's a great form of meditation because you can clear your mind,
yeah.
And you've got to sit there making they make those flies, you know. I've watched the guys making those things.
Yeah.
It's all very intricate. They're very proud of their flies. They keep them in a little box.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're all different kinds of them, very exotic.
It's not the flies that matter. It's maggots. Why would you want
No. But they don't use in fly fishing, of course, when they're catching salmon, they don't use maggots.
Yeah, right.
No, but no, I could never see the attraction, really. But
there you go. Horses for courses. He's very passionate about it. I like people who are passionate about their, you know, their hobbies, their sports, and their work. Now,
we used to have a freezer full of salmon that my husband had caught.
Oh, really?
And I've got a special fish kettle that you cook the fish in on the top of your hob and so on. But we did once cook a salmon in the dishwasher.
In the dishwasher?
Yeah, all wrapped up in foil. Obviously, you don't put detergent or any dirty dishes or anything like that, but you put it in the top shelf of the dishwasher and you poach it. In, you know, if you think the dishwasher water gets extremely hot.
I suppose it does.
And, well wrapped up in its foil, it comes out really lovely. And you have it with boiled new potatoes, fresh peas, and slices of lemon. That's all you need with a freshly cooked salmon. Yeah.
Next time after a freshly cooked salmon. I get my salmon out of a tin because I think that's the nicest possible salmon. I do. Tinned salmon. I love it, honestly. And particularly this time of the year now, I'll put that on top of some lettuce and wrap it up and have like lettuce salmon rolls, if you see what I mean. It crunches together nicely and it's very good. Talking about work, by the way, I'm absolutely going more and more mad about these civil servants who won't go back to work, empty offices. It's an outrage. It's an absolute disgrace that we as taxpayers employ people to run the country, but they can't even be arsed to get out of bed in the morning and go to work.
I do agree, but the workplace landscape has changed. This hybrid working, as they call it, is the new normal.
Mm.
You know, only 40% of employees want to return to office life full time.
Mm.
They prefer this work from home flexibility, and it's the number one employee benefit, I should say.
Yep.
So if you look up job ads on some of these sites, you know, they offer. Employers are offering hybrid working conditions.
Yes.
People have reevaluated their work-life balance. Mm. And the old model is out the door, Mike, I'm afraid.
Yeah. Well,
so I think it's never going to return. It's a bit like shops on the high street.
Yes.
We are going to see this as the way forward.
Yeah. Well, it's a way backward for me because you can only get the best out of people if you're what they now call headbanging, which we used to call, you know, exchanges of views, exchanges of ideas, you know, half an idea here and he's got half an idea and she's got a quarter of an idea. Bang, put them all together and you've suddenly got a great idea. Talking about working, right, I read a piece by Holly Willoughby in which she said she suffered for many years from imposter syndrome, okay? Now, some people would very unkindly say she's got a lot to be worried about being an imposter. But is that fair for a woman who's so terribly successful?
Well, do you remember Jill Dando talking about this years ago?
No, I don't know.
Before we had the name imposter syndrome,
yeah.
She used to say in interviews that she'd been so lucky in her career that she used to fret that she would be found out. In other words, that she wasn't really very good at anything at all.
Yeah.
And the thing about TV presenting, my dad used to say, you can either do it or you can't. You can't be trained to do it.
Yeah.
You've either got, the camera either loves you and you have an ability to communicate through a lens and to look as though you're talking to one person, yeah, as opposed to, you know, an audience of millions. Yeah. The camera loves Holly Willoughby, as my son calls her. Yeah. But it's not really a skill what she is exercising, is it?
Well, can anybody else do it? That's what you have to say to yourself.
Well, of course. Yeah, could anybody else? Many, many people can do what she does. Exactly. Of course they can.
Yeah.
And I do think the likes of Philip Schofield and Holly Willoughby are overrated and overpaid.
Yeah.
In her case, you'd have to say that her face, her hair, and her breasts are her fortune.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not really to do with what she's saying, because somebody else scripts that. Mm. She doesn't really have to think about what she's presenting.
He has to deliver. You could make that accusation of Tom Jones. He didn't write any of his songs, but he had to deliver them.
Yeah, it's a different skill, isn't it?
So, it is.
To be able to interpret and to sing a song with emotion,
yeah,
there's a skill in that. We can't all do that. Very few of us can do that.
Yeah.
But I think many, many of us can do what Holly Willoughby does.
Well,
we just don't look like her.
Yes, okay. Or maybe haven't had the opportunity. But again, that's about knocking on doors and kicking doors down until you get in there. I tell you who I think should have that sort of syndrome of imposter syndrome is Russell Brand. I have never, ever in my life worked out what that guy's supposed to be. He's never said anything that I think is funny. I've seen him in films in which he's been appalling. He mumbles and mutters on stage, and I wouldn't pay for a ticket to go and watch him talk for 45 minutes on stage. Have you ever worked him out?
Not really. He jumps on bandwagons, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does, yeah.
He gets into the whole woke thing.
Yeah.
I went off him entirely when he got onto the anti-vax bandwagon.
Yes, exactly.
Because he influenced a lot of young people against having vaccinations, yeah, when they would have done better to just bloody well go and get them.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I tell you the funny story about him. I think one of the reasons why he has done so well is he's got a very good management team behind him, right? So one of his management team turn up at the radio station I was working at once and sold the idea to the program director, who wasn't a fan of mine and I wasn't a fan of his, right? He sold him the idea that a weekend show, you could veer off sport and do a bit of entertainment, and why didn't they take Russell Brand's live stage show from the previous Wednesday, because he was on tour and he was doing a different sort of city every week, you know what I mean? Or the previous Friday or something like that. Why didn't they take Russell Brand live on stage with all the acoustics and the sound effects and the crowd shouting and cheering and all this kind of stuff, you know, and run it out on a Sunday, on a Saturday night and a Sunday morning? Of course, because it was Russell Brand, this programme director thought this is a brilliant idea, signed the deal for £10,000 a week for 12 weeks, okay? So that's pretty good, considering that Russell Brand had done the show in a live theatre and wasn't having to do it again on radio, you see what I mean? But so he got week one and that went out. It was kind of all right. And then the disc arrived for week two and the program director played it, and then he thought, they've sent me last week's. So he rang up the agent and he said, I think you've sent me last week's show. And, of course, the agent said, no, we haven't. That show was the one that Russell did this week in Nottingham. The previous week was in Newcastle. And the program director said,
it's all the same show?
Absolutely. The program director said, but it all sounds the same. And the agent said, well, of course it's the same. He said, it's the same show. It's just a different audience. We don't do a different show for Newcastle than we do to Nottingham, you know. And they had to pay him up. They didn't run any more because it was all the same show. But they had to pay him up the full value of the contract for doing that. So that's smart management.
What an absolute con, though.
Well, you know, somebody should have been a bit smarter in working out what they were actually getting, you know. But
contract is a contract.
Contract is a contract and all that kind of stuff, yeah. Right, OK, folks, that's it again for this week. Miss Jones, thank you very much indeed. And I can only say to everybody, spring has sprung, as you'll see from the logos we give you on Life on Planet Porky, and we'll be back with you very soon. I've got 10 black suits, I've got one blue jacket, one grey jacket, one blue blazer, but the only thing I look good in, because I'm overweight and, you know, I don't have any sort of, you know, defined body shape, is a black suit. Seriously, and I like a black suit and a blue shirt. I've got about 30 blue shirts, stripes or checks or you know, white with blue stripes in them. And you're absolutely right. For a bloke never gets sort of, you know, the microscope on him about what's he wearing today, because he's wearing a dark suit, which is what most male politicians wear, whereas females are always picked up on their fashion. But, you know, that's the great thing about being a woman. They need to look attractive, in my view, and it's a wonderful thing to see.
So I'm a pretty anti-woman in that case, because I just want to wear black suits all the time.
You look great
well.
In black, Leslie Ann. Look at all the pictures that I've seen of you over the years, and the pictures and, you know, that appear in your books and all that. You always look great. I wouldn't worry about
it,
to the extent where, you know, you even have your black sunglasses on most of the time. I get my salmon out of a tin, because I think that's the nicest possible salmon. I do, tinned salmon, I love it, honestly. And particularly this time of the year now, I'll put that on top of some lettuce and wrap it up and have, like, lettuce salmon rolls, if you see what I mean. It's an outrage, it's an absolute disgrace that we as taxpayers employ people to run the country, but they can't even be arsed to get out of bed in the morning and go to work.